Greetings to everyone, all of you here. We appreciate everybody and that you came, and greetings to those online, wherever you are and listening or watching, and whatever day you're watching this, may you be blessed, and hopefully God will help you, and I hope God will help me too, because this is a message from Him, and I don't want to do it anybody or do it by myself at all, but to do with His help in me. So this title is called The Saddest Marriage. The Saddest Marriage. Now, our news lately has been filled with the events surrounding shootings and troubles and every kind of trouble in this world. Even a bridge started to collapse in Stewart the other day. And the bridge was closed because of that. And so the infrastructure problems, political problems, religious problems, all kinds of problems we face. Well, in my own personal Bible study, I started during the COVID-19 episode we've been going through. I thought that to look at the prophecies in the Bible and to see how what was written is pertinent to us today. And so I hadn't really studied this book. I had read this book from it, little pieces. There were many references to it over all these years, but I had never really sat down and really studied the book of Amos. So I thought, well, I'm going to really look and study the book of Amos for a change. So I read it very slowly and to learn what was being taught there. And the pages of this little book is so amazing. And I found and discovered that so much of what he wrote and written, of course God inspired him to write, is coming true now. I thought the world is finally catching up to where Amos already was. He wrote things thousands of years ago. We're finally catching up to what he wrote. It's terrible. And it's not, it's just terrible what we're coming to. And he already wrote about it. This message is an attempt to bring out some understanding of both the times we're in, but this message isn't necessarily dedicated solely to the subject of Amos. Amos is the catalyst, if you will, to this message. I learned what I'm going to say today, came to it. That was kind of the catalyst of what I got into, which is the point of this message. But Amos is an important ingredient in it, okay? This is an attempt to bring out some understanding of both the times we're now in and the relationship of God and his people Israel. This is a great study, and I would recommend that any of us would look into these short books of the, or called the, the minor prophets. They're called the minor prophets because they're short, I suppose, but they're anything but minor in terms of their importance. They're very important. They tell a great deal of emphasis and information about what we can learn and to reflect on the circumstances in which we face right now. So anyway, I recommend that you would do a study of them if you haven't already. You may know way more than I do, and that's good for you. Mr. Veller has been going through the book of Hosea in our Zoom Bible studies on Wednesday evenings. Those books, are all important. Hosea, Micah, you name it. They all have their place. You just go through them. In my own personal Bible study, as I was going through Amos, I went through it because I had just to decide. I had to, let me just go through this book. I just chose it. Could have chosen any of them, but I chose Amos because I hadn't been through it. So I went through it, and the great majority of the prophecy and highlights, of course, are about the sins of Israel. He starts out going through the various sins of various nations in chapter 1. And you'll see he'll name these other nations, all right? But then when he finally gets to Israel, Israel is the one he really primarily was writing to. And he nails Israel down, okay? But here's the subject one I want to get to today. If you'll turn to Amos 5 and verse 1 and 2. Amos 5 and verses 1 and 2. Okay, I'm going to read this in the old King James. I brought my NIV today and New International Version because so much of it is easier reading. But I wanted to read this particular verse in the old King James because it has significance that I think is very important. In the old King James, it says, "Hear ye this word which I take up against you, even a lamentation, O house of Israel. The virgin of Israel is fallen. She shall no more rise. She is forsaken upon her land. There is none to raise her up." So as I'm going through the book of Amos, I come to this verse, these two verses, and I stop in my tracks. Say, why is he referring to this feminine pronoun 4 times in a row in the old King James? Two she's and two hers. Why did he make note of that? Why not just say Israel, it? Why make it she? Why say her? There's a reason for that. And so let's go find out what that is, you know, I said to myself. See, in the NIV, it says, "Hear this word, O house of Israel, this lament I take up concerning you. Fallen is virgin Israel, never to rise again, deserted in her own land with no one to lift her up." Well, they overlooked the idea of the virgin of Israel is fallen. There's 4 references there. They've eliminated at least 2 of them. Well, it's important to have them in there because we're trying to understand the relationship of God to Israel and Israel to God. There's a relationship here. And when this came to view, I asked myself about why did he use a feminine pronoun, and 4 times he mentions it. And it also has to do with the lamentation. If you'd like another Bible study to do, when you have nothing to do in your life, go through the book of Lamentations. It's right at the end of Jeremiah. It's a short book, 5 chapters in between Jeremiah and Ezekiel. And there is a whole book dedicated to God's relationship to Israel and what he is feeling and what they are doing and not doing and how it affects God and how he sees it. What I'm trying to emphasize today is an idea, trying to humanly, with my limited mind, try to grasp an understanding of what it's like for God to look at this situation. I look at it my way. What does God see? Is it possible for us to catch a glimpse of what God must be feeling? And that's what I'm trying to do today, if you help me. With this observation comes with it a marvelous remembrance that God had made a covenant of marriage with Israel. Remember that. The concept of marriage with its love, devotion, commitment, service to one another, and becoming faithful are all part of the hope and expectation of every marriage, ideally. Everyone who ever gets married goes into it expecting these things, hoping for these things. And when a man devotes himself to a particular lady, there's a certain element of expectation, of faithful trust, to be inherent in the relationship, legally bound together. A woman would expect the same from her husband, in whom she commits her life, her name, and her past freedom. Both are expecting big things from this relationship. Well, think of God relating to Israel. Do you think he didn't have some expectation of what this relationship was going to produce? Okay? So then we see in Amos 5 and verse 4, it says, "Do not seek Bethel, do not go to Gilgal, do not journey to Bathsheba, for Gilgal will surely go into exile, and Bethel will be reduced to nothing." There the Lord tells Israel to seek him. Don't go to these other things. It said in verse 4 at the end, seek me and live. See, this is what the Lord says to the house of Israel in verse 4. Seek me and live. Well, why would he say seek me and live if they were with him? He has to say seek me and live because they're not there. They're not together. Well, they were supposed to be married. There was supposed to be a covenant, right? So let's go into that a little bit, into this covenant relationship. So if we go to Ezekiel 16, we see something about this relationship and its development. Ezekiel 16 and verse 60. Yet I will remember the covenant I made with you in the days of your youth, and I will establish an everlasting covenant with you. What is he talking about? This covenant relationship with who? You. Who is you here? So then we go back to verse 8. And you can read through all of this. We don't have time right now to read a whole chapter. It's imperative to read this entire chapter and its whole thing. You have to understand the relationship of this lady to God and vice versa. It's labeled as Jerusalem, but it's the same principle. So in verse 8 of Ezekiel 16, he says, later I passed by, and when I looked at you and saw that you were old enough for love, I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you, declares the sovereign Lord, and you became mine. Okay? And then in verses 14 and 15, and he's speaking about this lady. And your fame spread among the nations on account of your beauty, because the splendor I had given you made your beauty perfect, declares the sovereign Lord. But you trusted in your beauty and used your fame to become a prostitute. You lavished your favors on anyone who passed by, and your beauty became his. Whoever you came by, you gave yourself to this guy, whoever it was. She's already supposed to be married to God. But what if you as a fellow were married to a lady and the lady decided to, behind your back, go off and go out in the street and listen, anybody that comes along, it's good enough. And you, what are you going to feel like? Jeremiah 2 and verse 2 we'll go to. There's so much in here that we could spend all day. Jeremiah 2:2. One other little tidbit I want to share about Bible study in general. As you go through the Bible, you can, these beautiful, wonderful themes that run throughout. It's like little rivers of themes that run throughout the Bible. And they're all running along. And one of the great themes of the Bible is this marriage between God and Israel, this relationship. Eventually, it's going to be all the children, the whole world will be joined into it. It's not meant to be limited to that eventually. But for now, for this human time, for our time, it's meant to be this relationship. And so here we are in Jeremiah 2 and verse 2. It's just something to keep in mind in your Bible study, to have in your mind that be watching for this theme running through. So now, getting back to Jeremiah 2 and verse 2, if I ever get there. Go and proclaim in the hearing of Jerusalem, I remember the devotion of your youth, how as a bride you loved me and followed me through the desert, through the land not sown. Israel was holy to the Lord, the first fruits of his harvest. All who devoured her, were held guilty, and disaster overtook them. He was looking out for her always. As a bride, you love me and followed me. She followed him wherever he would go. There was a devotion there. And then Jeremiah 31. Jeremiah 31. And verse 31 and 32. Jeremiah 31, 31 and 32. It says, "The time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they broke my covenant, though I was a husband to them." Well, if he's going to make a new covenant, doesn't that imply there was an old one? An old one was broken. Well, how did it get broken? You know, a logical question. But he says, I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt because they broke my covenant, though I was an husband to them, declares the Lord. There's a relationship here between these two entities, these two beings, if you will. Now, Jeremiah 3, go back to Jeremiah 3. He tells about her behavior. Jeremiah 3, verse 12 to 14. Jeremiah 3, verse 12 to 14. Says, "Go proclaim this message toward the north. Return, faithless Israel, declares the Lord. I will frown on you no longer." This is the hope. I am merciful, declares the Lord. "I will not be angry forever. Only acknowledge your guilt. You have rebelled against the Lord your God. You have scattered your favors to foreign gods under every spreading tree, and have not obeyed me, declares the Lord. Return, O return, faithless people, declares the Lord, for I am your husband. I will choose you, one from a town and two from a clan, and bring you to Zion." He's still the husband. He wants her back. He doesn't want to give up on her, even though she's out running around. And so we go back to Amos again. Go back to Amos. We're going to hop around throughout the scriptures here. And one of the reasons I'm hopping around is to illustrate again the idea of the theme running through. It's like a river running through the whole Bible, is this idea of the relationship, this marriage thing going on. It's running through here. It started way back in Genesis, you know. So if you have to look for it, it's all embedded in the wording. But anyway, Amos 3, if I ever get there. Amos 3, verse 1. Says, "Hear this word the Lord has spoken against you, O people of Israel, against the whole family I brought up out of Egypt." And then verse 3. "Can two walk together unless they have agreed to do so?" This is a classic verse that we have referred to over the years. In many sermons will mention this particular verse. "Can two walk together unless they be agreed," in the old King James. And so I never really realized who were the two that were walking together. Well, the two who were walking together was Israel and God. Can Israel and God walk together unless they are agreed? Well, if they're not agreed, then they're not walking together. Who gave up their agreement? There was a covenant there initially. Then how did it get separated? Then they're not agreed now. You know? So then verse 10 and 11, "They do not know how to do right, declares the Lord, who hoard plunder and loot in their fortresses." What happened within the last week or so about looting? Did we have any looting take place in this country? "Therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says, an enemy will overrun the land." Huh? An enemy will overrun the land? Look into that. He will pull down your strongholds and plunder your fortresses. That doesn't sound good. Chapter 6 and verse 3 to 6 and 7. Let's see, 6:3. You put off the evil day and bring near a reign of terror. You lie in beds inlaid with ivory. This is a kind of a note about wealthy people, how that they put, there's a people that put themselves above others, and they live in this lofty tower. They live in a place above other people. And often it's at the expense of the little people that they live that way. You lie on beds inlaid with ivory and lounge on your couches. You dine on choice lambs and fattened calves. You strum away on your harps like David and improvise on musical instruments. You drink wine by the bowlful and use the finest lotions, but you do not grieve over the ruin of Joseph. What is the ruin of Joseph? When there's ruin in Joseph, we just read about this other episode here where they come and it's not a good situation. There is great ruin. Joseph is another word that has to do with Israel. Israel came from Joseph. Joseph, the two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, were the sons of Joseph. And Jacob put his hands across, he crossed his hands to put his name on those two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And he put his name on them. They became Israel. And where is Israel today? Israel still exists today. So, let's see. I was going to read the verse 7. Therefore, you will be among the first to go into exile. Your feasting and lounging will end. Whew, doesn't sound good. Can we know or understand the nature of a loved mate who turns away in utter abandonment and betrayal? The feeling of a friend or mate being betrayed. And this is what Israel was doing to God, betraying him. Well, the feeling of a friend or mate being betrayed is probably one of the most hurtful events that could happen to a person. There was that you had a solemn trust and a solemn belief in this person. I could trust them. I could be with them. I could always depend. I could tell them anything. They'll hold it sovereign to themselves. I can trust them. There's an expectation that it will last all of our lives. One can be confident, and then only to be betrayed and to have them see that, oh, it was just a lie. What a devastation. What a disappointment that would be. Well, Mr. Veller has been going through in his Zoom Bible studies the book of Hosea. And to have Hosea know what it was like to be married to an unfaithful wife, God had him marry a woman who was, as the old King James described, a wife of whoredoms. So if you go to Hosea chapter 1, we'll spend a little time in Hosea now. Hosea 1 and verse 2, and this is in the NIV again. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, go, take to yourself an adulterous wife and children of unfaithfulness, because the land is guilty of the vilest adultery in departing from the Lord. Israel was in the process of departing from the Lord. And so God had Hosea live through this to illustrate what it felt like. And so Gomer is representational of Israel. If you go to Hosea, let's see, it says here in verse 8, it talks about Gomer. her name was Gomer, this lady that he married. Well, let's see. Hosea 2, 5 to 8. Hosea 2. It says, rebuke your mother, rebuke her, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. Let her remove the adulterous look from her face and the unfaithfulness from between her breasts. Otherwise, I will strip her naked and make her bare as on the day she was born. I will make her like a desert, turn her into a parched land, and slay her with thirst. I will not show my love to her children, because they are children of adultery. Their mother has been unfaithful and has conceived them in disgrace. She said, I will go after my lovers, who give me my food and my water, my wool and my linen, my oil and my drink. It was supposed to be her husband she was supposed to go to for those things. God would have given all those things, and he wanted to give her all those things. But instead, she goes after her lovers to let them give her all this stuff and not go to God. And so, in chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, chapter 3, verse 1 and 2, the Lord said to me, go, show your love to your wife again, though she is loved by another and is an adulteress. Love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods and love the sacred raisin cakes. So Hosea was told to go and buy her. She was put on an auction block. She was so pitiful, she was put on an auction block. So Hosea was told to go and buy her back. Well, he goes and buys her back. And says in verse 2, so I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and about an homer and a lethek of barley. Not a whole lot. Then I told her, you are to live with me many days. You must not be a prostitute or be intimate with any man, and I will live with you. If you'll just change, you know. And then, let's see, I have chapter 4 and verse 16 to 19. Chapter 4, 16 to 19. The Israelites are stubborn, like a stubborn heifer. How then can the Lord pasture them like lambs in a meadow? Ephraim is joined to idols. Leave him alone. Even when their drinks are gone, they continue their prostitution. Their rulers dearly love shameful ways. And then Hosea 5 and verse 7. I have to read this in the Old King James for the sake of the wording. It says, they have dealt treacherously against the Lord, for they have begotten strange children. Now shall a month devour them with their portions. It says new moon in the other versions. Well, Mr. McNeely had made mention of this verse some time ago in one of his Beyond Today broadcasts. And he mentioned about the month and how quickly things can change in this series in the time of a month. How many of you can remember what it was like in mid-March of this year compared to mid-April of this year? Say from March 15th to April 15th, what happened in this country? In 1 month, the whole nation changed, let alone April to May, you know? So it isn't inconceivable to think that something dramatic can happen in a relatively short time. And then 5 and 13, chapter 5 and verse 13, when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah his sores, then Ephraim turned to Assyria and sent to the great king for help, for he is not able to cure you, not able to heal your sores. Here again, the countries are going to their enemies for their help. Instead of going to God, which is what would really help them, they turn to these other nations, which will not help them. But they're too stubborn to see that. They're too obstinate. They've turned away from God. And then we go back to Amos. Amos 2, 6 and 7. More illustration of this information here. This is what the Lord says. For three sins of Israel, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath. They sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. How low can you go? They trample on the heads of the poor as upon the dust of the ground and deny justice to the oppressed. Do you think there's adequate and proper judgment made in our country for the poor or oppressed? Is it always fair? Who gets the justice? These are the kind of things that are happening in our land. You think God is pleased? Isaiah 10 and verse 1 and 2. Isaiah 10 and verse 1 and 2. Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees, to deprive the poor of their rights and withhold justice from the oppressed of my people. Do you know anything about that in our world today? Do you ever see evidence of that in your daily walk in the newspapers of today? Do you ever see anything like, oh, that never happens to us? Oh, they have dealt treacherously against the Lord. So what is God feeling like? Here is this young woman that he took and raised her up and married her. He cleaned her. He loved her. He gave his life for her. There was an expectation of a joyous marriage. Instead, what actually happened? Let's go over to the book of Joel. Joel. Joel comes after Hosea. Joel 1 and verse 8. Joel 1 and verse 8. The NIV says, mourn like a virgin in sackcloth, grieving for the husband of her youth. Old King James has, lament like a virgin girded with sackcloth for the husband of her youth. Israel isn't so happy about this whole thing either. There's a lot of lamentation, a lot of lamenting, a lot of sadness and disappointment going on here. And then we read in Proverbs 2, it talks about being delivered. What God wants to accomplish. Proverbs chapter 2 and verse 17, well, 16 and 17. Proverbs 2, 16 and 17. He's talking about using wisdom. And it says, it will save you also from the adulteress, from the wayward wife with her seductive words, who has left the partner of her youth and ignored the covenant she made before God. So what was the original covenant? Let's go back to an original statement based upon Genesis 2 and verse 24. Genesis 2 and 2 and verse 24. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. The original idea of marriage. God was duplicating that in a bigger way by marrying Israel. Now, if you go to Exodus chapter 19, Exodus 19, this is the chapter just before the giving of the law in Exodus 20. But in Exodus 19, he has something to say about this covenant. Exodus 19, verse 5 and 6. Now, if you obey me fully, this is verse 5, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then will all the nations you will be my then of all the nations you will be my treasured possession, although the whole earth is mine. You will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you will speak to the Israelites. This was supposed to be a holy people, people who would be representational of the relationship of a people with God, and to see the fruits that that would bear. It would be a happy, joyful fruit that would be born, and that that fruit would spill over into the other nations, and everybody would benefit from it. Everybody around the earth would benefit, every nation would benefit from this relationship going well. But here we see that Israel, what Israel would have been, that what its ideal was supposed to be, what God wanted them to become, an holy nation, and holy people unto God, a special people separate from the other nations, so that the other nations would aspire by their examples, so that they too would have a relationship ultimately with God, that they would also choose God's way. They would see how well they're, well, how come they're doing so well? Because they believe in that God. Oh, well, why don't we believe in the God too? Then we can share in that blessing. Good idea. Let's try that. Well, what do you know? It works. Well, now we're happy. Well, what's... It gets me the thing about the world, how they we pursue so hard in trying to do things so that we'll be happy. And yet when we do what we do and then we're not happy, then we try harder to do something that's going to make us happy by fouling up something else. And we're trying to get to happiness. Well, why not undo all this stuff, go to God and ask him and go directly to happiness? Wouldn't that be logical? Why waste all this time and energy and people dying and all this stuff we're doing? Anyway, there's another element to this whole story that has to do with the name. One of the other elements of marriage is that a wife takes on the name of her husband. And when Israel became married to God, guess whose name she would have represented? And so, if you go to Leviticus 20, for example, Leviticus chapter 20, Leviticus 20, verses 6 and 7, 20, 6 and 7. Six says, I will set my face against the person who turns to mediums and spiritists to prostitute himself by following them, and I will cut him off from his people. Consecrate yourselves and be holy, because I am the Lord your God. Keep my decrees and follow them. I am the Lord who makes you holy. So they're supposed to be separate. And then Leviticus 20 and verse 3, go back up to verse 3. It says, I will set my face against that man, and I will cut him off from his people, for by giving his children to Molech, he has defiled my sanctuary and profaned my holy name. And then we'll go to Ezekiel chapter 36. go to Ezekiel chapter 36. Ezekiel 36 and verse 20. 36 and verse 20. It says, "And wherever they went among the nations, they profaned my holy name. For it was said of them, these are the Lord's people, and yet they had to leave his land." Now, isn't that a disgrace for God's name? To be dragged along that way, and then for the other nations to look at that in disgust. Oh. These are the Lord's people. That's what they were saying of God's people. And yet they had to leave his land. What does that do to God's name when it's been destroyed by these guys? And what he... when he married Israel, he put his name on her, she's supposed to represent him. Every wife represents her husband in some way. We represent God by our being in the church, and we, in a sense, are married to Jesus Christ. We're married to God because we are part of his relationship. So God has placed his name on us. "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain," it says in the third commandment. Why do you not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain? Among other reasons, it's because God's name is holy. It's reverent. If you go to Psalm 111, verse 9. Psalm 111, verse 9. I think in here it doesn't say it the same way. Psalm 111, verse 9. It says, "He provided redemption for his people. He ordained his covenant forever." It says, "Holy and awesome is his name." Well, it's not just awesome. It's reverend. It's separated. It's something to be feared. It's something to revere. It's something to be made afraid of. You don't dare want to take God's name in vain. You don't dare want to treat it with anything other than the deepest of respect. It's awesome. It's beautiful. It is awesome. That's true. But it's even more of a dimension than just awesome, because he's saying it that way. But yet Israel was profaning it, he said. And let's go over to Romans. See, the thing keeps running through here. Romans. Romans 2, verse 24. Romans 2, 24. It says, "As it is written, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you." Do you want to be guilty of blaspheming God's name? Drag it in the mud? Nathan came to David after David's sin with Bathsheba, and he told David, you essentially have given great occasion to your enemies by doing that. It makes God's name look bad. You are representational of God, and the other nations know it. And here you sin, that makes the whole name look bad. What that must have meant to David when he realized, you know. Go back to Amos 3. There's still hope. In spite of all, there's still, God is amazing. There's still hope. Go back to Amos. There's one little verse here, stuck in the midst here. There's other verses, but look at this. Amos 3 and verse 12. Chapter 3 and verse 12. Says, "This is what the Lord says. As a shepherd saves from the lion's mouth, only two leg bones or a piece of an ear, so will the Israelites be saved. Those who sit in Samaria on the edge of their beds and in Damascus on their couches. Now, what kind of God do we worship? What kind of God do we know? What kind of God is the one who called us? Yet he, all this sin, all this trouble, all this difficulty, and yet he still holds out this hope. I'm still going to rescue them in the end. I still love them. Isaiah 54 and verse 5. Isaiah 54 and verse 5. It keeps running, brethren. It keeps running through here. Read it. Try to understand it. I'm trying to understand it too. I don't understand it all. I'm not saying I do. I don't. But I'm trying to grasp what little I do understand. It says, let's see, 54:5. For your Maker is your husband. The Lord Almighty is his name. The Holy One of Israel is your Redeemer. He is called the God of all the earth. Your Redeemer. What did he do with Jesus Christ? Sent him back to give his life so that the people could be redeemed, bought back. Talk about giving up your life for somebody. Talk about love. And Jeremiah 3. Jeremiah 3. Jeremiah 3 and verse 14. Return, faithless people, declares the Lord, for I am your husband. I will choose you, one from a town and two from a clan, and bring you to Zion, bring you to my place. He's still at it. We learn a great deal about our great God and how he expresses his feelings and emotions intermixed with the prophecies regarding his people Israel. For Israel's part, we see our days just now that we are living through, how the prophecies and descriptions of how it would be are being written on our headlines and our news reports as you look at them, and that this nation is a modern extension of ancient Israel, as we see it continually turning away from God in its behavior and its priorities of what it considers to be important. We just had those things occur recently in the last week or so. And it will continue. As the lady he married years ago abandons her responsibility and turns to treacherous betrayal to all that God has provided and given to this great land, we can think and consider deeply the feelings of hurt and disappointment that God must be feeling. Does anybody care what God feels? We are told to be able to grieve and lament in the book of Ezekiel 9, verse 4. Old King James says, sigh and cry. We mentioned in that other verse earlier that they could not grieve for the problems of Joseph. We've gotten so cold and calloused, and our brains are it's like a flint. We can't feel, we can't hurt, we can't be caring about anybody. We become robots, our nation is like people made of metal or something. Are they made of stone? They can do things, the horrible, horrible things to people. Doesn't it mean anything? Don't you feel the pain they're feeling when you're doing things like this to them? Well, they did it to us. Well, how does it fix it? By doing it to them. It doesn't fix it. You have to stop it and turn to God's ways. Let's ask God to give us caring and softened hearts that can feel a lot more of what he feels, and that we are moved with compassion to do our part to bring God joy and praise and faithfulness and trust in him, and that can be taught to the rest of the world in due time. And that's what we're preparing for, to be able to teach this to the whole world and to care about them when they don't know God's way. And we can't just let them go and just let them be that way. No. Let's help them. Let's be a part of the solution, not part of the problem.